Welcome to Regenerative Spaces, a podcast that explores holistic and sustainable paths toward thriving in the fields of agriculture, education, spirituality, and beyond. Hey there, and welcome to Regenerative Spaces. I'm your host, Stacy Pellice. I'm a regenerative farmer in Santa Barbara, California, but my background and interests span a much broader range of fields, from psychology to spirituality and beyond. In my 3+ decades as an environmental activist, author, and educator, I've gotten increasingly curious about the links between the various ecosystems humans occupy. On this podcast, I'm inviting you to get curious with me. These episodes feature approachable conversations with inspiring experts in different disciplines, from intuitive healers and nonprofit founders to activists and educators. We'll cover county politics, cattle ranching, and a whole world of other specialties in between. These folks are all at the forefront of their chosen fields, and each one offers a unique perspective on holistic, sustainable, and regenerative possibilities for our individual and collective lives. I'm so honored to be introducing you to Eric Nagelman, a close friend of mine and a true luminary in the world of landscape design. From his early days as a child tending his family's garden in Montecito, to his eventual role as an acclaimed international landscape designer, his passion, love for plants, and a uniquely rebellious nature have been the driving forces throughout his life. Despite facing challenges as a young person, important mentors showed him that being bold, colorful, and original was his birthright. And a star was born. Eric's deep involvement with Lotus Land, especially his work on the cactus garden, palm garden, and insectary garden, as well as important estates in Montecito, Los Angeles, Mexico, and Europe, stand as testament to his talent and commitment to botanical excellence. But Eric's story doesn't stop there. A few years ago, he embarked on a new chapter in Taos, New Mexico, with the development of an LGBTQIA+ teen resource center, a project close to his heart, born out of his own experiences and the need to provide support and guidance to young people facing similar challenges. I can't wait for you to hear this celebration of the life, work, and enduring legacy of Eric Nagelman, a true advocate for positive change. So without further ado, let's get started. Hello, Eric. I am so happy you're here. It wasn't easy, but we're here together, aren't we?
It's a howdy-doody show.
It kind of is.
But what's a howdy-doody?
Anyway? I think a wooden puppet. That is not you by any stretch, or me. So I want to start, because we're so close, we could just carry on, but we want to include listeners. So listen, how I think we met was we had heard amazing things about this brilliant landscape designer back when we lived on the Miramar house, at the Miramar house. And you and I were walking around the property, and it was an old property, over 100 years old, and hadn't been maintained for quite some time. And we were finding all kinds of, you know, toys, and there was a statue with a head cut off, a classical Greek statue, and it wasn't supposed to be cut off. And you just said, looked at me and said, "Oh my God, this is creepy." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I think we can be friends." Because you were just, you had a sense of humor, you were honest, you were like.
What year was this?
I'm going to say 1999, 2000. It could have been a year later, but that's what I'm going to say. And I don't know where we found you, actually. I don't know who I can thank, but it was destined.
But 25 years ago, more or less.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Something like that.
Something like
that. But anyway, that was the beginning of a long relationship, both professionally. You have landscaped some of the most gorgeous properties. And for us, the ranch is one, the tea house, and others. And then also, most recently, a project that you and I both did for Lotus Land that was your brainchild, which was the Lotus Land Sustainability Symposium, which was fabulous. And I hope that it continues. But more importantly is that you and I have developed a friendship. We would bring our lunch to our meetings. We'd sit down and we'd get into these deep, deep conversations. And now we're just, I mean, years ago, we realized it's like, okay, we're just getting together. And I'm so grateful. You're one of my most precious, wise friends. So I kind of want to get into all of it, but I want to introduce how I know you and how much I love you and your unique vision, your unique soul, your unique path. So with that, I would ask, right, you know, you are this very famous, world-renowned landscape designer. How did you get there? Like, were you destined to be this? Have you always been that person? Could you share with us maybe a little bit how you see how this all started for you?
Of course I can share it. And, you know, I don't know. I believe in angels, and I believe the angels have brought me to where I am today. I had no aspirations. I had no goals. I was just about love. So when I was very young, maybe 8 years old, I don't know, I fell in love with plants. I grew up on this fairly large piece of property, and at one time it had a beautiful garden. So the bones were still there, although we didn't have a gardener, we didn't have funds for that. I'm one of nine children, so it was a stretch. So anyway, I could see the bones of this old garden, and I started, you know, and kind of learning what these plants were and how they grow, and I could take cuttings of these plants, I could divide them and reuse them, and to me that was magical. And then I would do arranging. I was thinking this morning, actually, remembering how even inside the house, my mother always had a lot of knickknacks, and I was always rearranging them. And so, you know, I think it was really the love of plants that brought me to where I am today. And I still love plants. I don't live in California anymore, so coming back is just like going through my history of seeing all these incredible plants, and I still remember all their names. I still have, the only thing that I've ever kept my whole life are these two big books, one called Exotica and one called Tropicana. And they're like big plant encyclopedias. And I still have those books to this day. And I remember as a kid just you know, going through these books and looking at these pictures of people in the Amazon with all these amazing plants, and you know, school didn't work for me, so I would spend all my time in these books studying these plants. And you know, I had no idea where I was going to go with this, but I think it started with that, just the love of plant material and the magic of plant life and what I can do with it, how it talks to you. And you know, I've always been very sensitive, so I can, you know, I can feel the energy of these plants, I can feel the exoticness and the magic of what we can do with them. And since then, I've worked everywhere from Hong Kong through Mexico, through the US and Europe. And there's always been that underlying language. So, you know, I don't speak any Chinese, but in Hong Kong, I would go to these nurseries and the Latin names of these plants is universal. So I could be in Italy, I could be in Mexico, I could be anywhere in the world. And I would say, you know, leptospermum or something. And they would pronounce it differently, of course, but they would know what I'm talking about.
Wow.
And to me, that's like a secret language. I mean, who doesn't want a secret language?
I do. Yeah. Mystery. So there's mystery, kind of.
There's absolute mystery. And, you know, that documentary I did a while ago, I talked about how, you know, when I do a garden, it's like having children, because you have an idea how they're going to turn out, but you don't really know.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's the unknown that, you know, that the magic of of time and life. It's a life form. I could never be an architect because, first of all, I can't measure anything. But architecture to me, and I love architecture, don't get me wrong, but it's very finite. It's, you know, things have to be perfectly lined up and da 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 da. Whereas landscape architecture has so much more freedom to it. And yes, the overall picture has to, you know, be figured out. I actually coined a phrase that I love. It's inconsistency amongst the consistency. So yeah, you can have the bones of this garden or this space, and that to me is like safety. But then inside that is just like freedom and do this and do that and oh, wouldn't that be cool? So I love the freedom of it.
Can I ask, like, when you say bones, do you mean hardscape, or do you mean in your head you got an idea of shapes that you carve out or plants that are going to anchor a space? What do you mean? What structure do you hold?
I think certainly the hardscape, but also just the perimeters of the space. Mm-hmm. You know, like I love the safety of having like a courtyard. You have these walls around you. I love that safety. It's like being in a womb. Mm-hmm. But then inside those walls in that courtyard, that's where the fun begins. That's where expression happens.
Well, my experience, at least here, and I think you had a lot to do with that, is that you would create spaces through plants, and they didn't have walls, but they were moments, you might say. And another trademark I think I learned from you is that, oh, there's this big view, like our Las Entradas house had this big view. Well, you wanted a tree in the middle of it, or because nature doesn't follow those rules. Nature doesn't say, I paid extra for this view. I'm getting it all mow it all down. That's not how.
Let's keep it real, right?
Right. But oddly, that is unconventional, I would say, in your field.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a personal thing. Everybody has their opinion, but to me, perspective is so important. So yeah, you can have this beautiful view of the ocean, but how do you take it into context unless you have something to balance it or something mm-hmm. to give you that sense of where you are and what's out there?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's a felt sense that I've experienced. When you first said it many, many years ago, I was shocked by that. You literally said, I like having things a little bit in the way. You'll still see the reservoir from the house if we put some trees here. But it was not something that I had ever known about somebody that would do that. And it ended up being absolutely brilliant. And it gives you a feeling that you are in more of a natural space, more than a man-made, gridded out space. It's just two different feelings.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the flip side would be a minimalist. Well, I've never been accused of being a minimalist.
No.
I'm more like Tony Duquette, who says more is more.
Well, I would say that is one of your themes.
My trademark.
In many ways. But I mean, there's so many things we can talk about, but I kind of want to go back, if it makes sense to you, back to your pathway here. And I'm wondering, were there any particular plants that spoke more than others? And in terms of you going from a young child to, let's say, a teen or whatnot, in this community, were there any influences? What are some other markers along the young Eric's path?
Well, you know, I mentioned this property where I grew up.
Yeah.
In high school, when I first went to high school, I had an art teacher there named Jack Baker, and I didn't get along with my birth father, but he became like my surrogate father. And he definitely mentored me. He was so supportive and so giving in his world. He gave me so much. I learned so much from him about expressing myself.
And what was his field of study? Like, what was his?
Oh, he was an artist. He was a painter. He was more of a decorative artist, mm-hmm. Big floral paintings and animals and so on and so forth. But his home, well, first, when I first started working for him, he worked in a bunkhouse on Rancho Monte Alegre, which was an old stagecoach stop in Carpinteria, fabulous old ranch. And he lived in this wonderful bunkhouse.
Oh.
And then he bought this property on Rincon Point that was originally the garage is an apartment for the house above it. And he turned it into this magical house. And the same man who worked for Tony Duquette worked for Jack. And they created that, like, this courtyard had like Moroccan blue walls, and it had pink columns and orange trellises. And then it gave me so much freedom. I could do whatever I want. So it was like bringing in like bignonia vines or red trumpet vines is probably a common name. And just playing with these colors and adding to them. And so taking this, again, this consistency of this courtyard and these colors that were architectural, and then playing with them with the plant material, bougainvilleas, and oh, it's so much fun. And I worked for him for years, and like I said, he would just let me do whatever I wanted. And I worked there every Saturday, and I became interested in cactus. And so it was like a combination of tropicals and cactus and you know, things that were unpredictable, and you wouldn't think that they would go together, but I love that sort of science fiction quality of it, and totally impractical. I'm extremely impractical, but who cares? Figure it out. So, I mean, it's a little extra work, but the magic of it is what got me so excited. And working with Jack, he was bigger than life. You know, he's one of those people that everyone wanted to have at their parties because he was so much fun. And he gave, I think he really instilled in me my attribute of being creative, because he was so creative and so supportive and just let me do what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was a magic time in my life. I was so lucky to have experienced that. And because he was such a social person here in Santa Barbara, you know, he knew all these amazing people, and it was a time when there were incredible people living in Montecito, like Wright Ludington, Margaret Mallory, you know, people who had money and bought art and lived with art and yeah, I was very fortunate to be here in that time. It was a lot of things that came together. And then, so I did a lot of gardening. I lived with Dame Judith Anderson and worked in her garden and started doing gardening. And that was how I made a living. I actually just came from Casa del Herrero, which is this amazing estate in Montecito, which is now a foundation, but I lived and worked there when it was still privately owned. And it's just like quintessential Andalusian magic land. And it was so fun going back there today because I hadn't been there in many decades. So it brought back a lot of memories, but it also brought back the torture of it, because they wouldn't allow any mechanical equipment. So edging the lawns with hedge clippers, you know, squatting down, it was torture. The orchards, they wouldn't allow weed whackers or anything. So I had to hoe all these orchards by hand. I mean, it was hard work. So now they have four full-time gardeners plus volunteers. Well, when I was there, it was just me and one other gardener.
Wow. I did not know this.
Go, go, go. Rush, rush, rush. You know, fast, fast, fast. It was really hard.
Thank God you were young.
Yes, I was young, but I still have the battle wounds.
Okay.
A lot of PTSD.
Oh.
So I didn't last very long there because it was really kind of boring, but what a beautiful place. And so then I just had different clients and did a lot of gardening, and that sort of evolved into design work. And I became, you know, I didn't do gardening anymore except for myself because I still love gardening. But then it became more like designing gardens and that kind of brought me up to today. So I had no aspirations to become and do what I do, but it all evolved. And I have to credit the angels for that, because there's no other way that I can explain it.
The angels and Jack Baker.
Jack Baker and all the other characters in my life.
Yeah,
you.
Right.
Lotus Land. I mean, well, I used to do garden tours in some of my gardens as fundraisers for Lotus Land, and so they were familiar with my work and my style. And then they asked, "Can I talk about Lotus Land a little bit?"
Absolutely. I was going to ask you to talk about your relationship because I know it's a very important one.
It's a very important.
Yeah, absolutely.
So after doing these garden tours and they became familiar with my work, they asked me to do this cactus garden, and I was like, really? So the cactus garden started, Sig Dunlap had started this collection of cacti in 1930. And we have documented the plants, where he got them, and, you know, if there were seeds or cuttings. So all the plants are documented. And he had met Madame Gonowalska and asked if his collection could come to Lotus Land when he passed away. Well, he hadn't passed away, but it was, you know, he was like 90 or something, and it, you know, he couldn't really take care of it.
And Gonowalska is the woman whose estate this was that later became the Botanic Garden Lotus Land, for those of you not from
one of the 10 top gardens in the world.
Wow.
So, you know, first of all, to be asked to do a garden there is like,
yeah, that's a big deal.
It's a big deal. So anyway, he was still alive, and he contacted Lotus Land and said, you know, I think you need to come and take this collection. So the Lotus Land staff and other professionals moved all these cacti up to the property at Lotus Land and put them in storage, and then asked me to design this garden. And at first I thought, I don't know how to do this. But then I thought, well, you know, I'll just do it the way I always do it. So I started doing this garden, and anyway, developed into what it is now, which is one of my biggest achievements of my life, is how I feel about it.
And rightly so. You can see it online or in books, and it's really from another planet. But when you say, I want to slow down a second and say, when you say I did it how I always do it, and I want you to just sort of name that just a little bit, even though I could guess what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, the way I would, if I was invited to do a new garden, what I would do is first speak to the clients and get their, you know, what their wishes are, with their, because it's not my properties. It's whoever this person is. It's their property. It's their garden. It's their vision. So I would, you know, first get a feeling from them, and then whatever their vision is, I felt that my job was take that to another level. Or if they had no idea, then I would just do it myself. So anyway, that's how I approach this cactus garden, in that I have these plants, I have this space. Now, what do I do with it?
And wait, let me interject one more thing, which is when you said take it to another level, because I believe you've explained this to me. I have an idea for what I want. You get a sense of it. And then what you like to do is, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is to sort of push my outer limits of what I think it could
exactly
be. So you have this vast breadth of knowledge. So you like to pull people beyond their little known limits, which has many sort of emotional, psychological implications. I mean, it's fabulous what you're talking about. It's like, who can I be? Possible self. It's like, wow, I never would have imagined this, but I love it somehow. That's what I've noticed.
Yeah, I feel like that's my job. That's what I do. And I happen to have this incredible plant knowledge. I may not know a lot of things, but I know a lot about plants. And I love plants, and I love playing with them and creating with them. You know, most people, the general public, don't know a lot about plants, and nor should they.
I mean, it's nice to know. I've always thought, I think we should all know local flora and fauna. I think that should be basic curriculum in schools. Mm-hmm. Because I think everyone needs to understand the nature community they live in. That's a community of living things.
Well, I can't argue with that. But yeah, a lot of people aren't interested, and that's fine. You know, one time I gave a talk to a bunch of kids at Lotus Land, and I was in the cactus garden waiting for them to arrive. And they arrived, and they had been through a lot of gardens, so they were like, ah. And I thought, I got to get their attention. And I hadn't planned anything for this talk. So I just screamed really loud, passion. And they sort of stopped, like, what? And I started talking about Madame Gonowalska and her passion. I started talking about my passion. And I don't care what you're interested in. Find what ticks you inside. What makes you, because for me, I feel it right here.
Mm-hmm, like at the heart level.
Right in the heart level. And whatever touches you, if it's fine, whatever it is, I don't care. Find what touches you. Don't listen to anybody else, because I didn't. And find what makes you tick and work on that. Make that the best you can make it. That's how I feel about it.
Well, it's interesting because in one hand, you grew up in a household, let's say, that didn't have the supports for who you were growing up, let's say. I mean, a lot of us, you know, it's like some people maybe had a perfect upbringing. I know I did not. I went to schools that were not perfect, you know, and so they somehow, school curriculum often missed me. And I know you and I have talked about that at length. And yet you had the good fortune, the good angels that brought mentors and teachers and examples of another way to live and other aspects of yourself to access. So that for me, I would say as a young person, maybe it might have impacted my self-esteem, you know, early on, that I then had to spend years trying to put back together through just accepting my own self. And would you say just because of who you knew that your self-esteem, like you always had that confidence? Or would you say, and it doesn't have to be a clean cut story, but I'm just curious about that. For those of us who are a little different, you know, and maybe everyone's different, but I just wonder if you don't fit perfectly into the square peg, for those listeners who also are young and still trying to fit in, or are a little older and still struggling with that aspect of acceptance and compassion for yourself and who you are, you know?
That's a lot. Well, I think I've always had a rebellious nature. So I never had much of self-esteem until later in life, but I had a rebellious nature. So like I said, school didn't work for me. It didn't work for me, and I didn't care what, you know, if it wasn't the proper thing to do, because it didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. And somehow I had the strength and the fortitude to not pay attention to that and do what I wanted to do, because it worked for me.
That makes sense.
And again, I didn't know what I was doing, but I just knew it didn't work for me. And so I had to find alternative things that did work for me, that did make me tick, that did get me excited. And
you know, it's funny you mentioning that, not loving school. And I'm going to say, when was this? Back in 2012, maybe? I was 2013. I had finished my dissertation. I got to know Jose Caballero at Santa Barbara High School. He was teaching down in a classroom, a garden space. And we suddenly needed to redo it because they had to remove the structure because it was dilapidated. So my husband, Ron, and I got really involved and started raising money, and we donated, and we got an architect, Pam and Brett Ettinger, architect, to design a new outdoor classroom structure. And then it's like, well, we need somebody to help design the land itself, the plant material. And I remember asking you, because by then we'd worked together and we really knew each other. And I remember you said, I don't think I can do that. I have not been back on that. You went to Santa Barbara High. You were a Don. And you were like, I don't think I can do that. And maybe you weren't a Don, but technically you were a Don. But you said, I don't know if I can do that, because that was just a really hard time for me. But I'm imagining, because you trusted me, you said, well, okay, I'll go down there. And you showed up, and there was a process. And I feel like that began to unlock something for you about connecting with your young self.
Yeah, and learning forgiveness and forgiving and not forgetting. I love that terminology. Yeah, it was a tough time, but I did have this background of already having quite a bit of plant knowledge and experience, and so I was there was a landscape class in high school. The first year I did attend high school, and there was a landscape class there.
In that same spot?
Well, the classroom was up above, but the greenhouses were there. So being as how the teacher recognized that I kind of knew something, I had a lot of privileges.
Oh.
Instead of listening to, sitting in the classroom and listening to talk about plants, because I already knew all that stuff, he gave me permission to go down in the greenhouses and work. So I would be down there by myself repotting Cattleya orchids and, doing whatever I did. So it gave me a lot of freedom. And I think that probably had something to do with how I just realized that if it doesn't work for me, that there are alternatives. And I think that's a really important thing because, if something doesn't work, find what does make it work. I think that's sort of been an MO in my life. If it doesn't work, find out what makes it work.
Well, and that's what's so brilliant about these programs that I'm seeing high schools do more and more. Now that spot is called the Green Lab at Santa Barbara High, and it's kind of a magnet for young people that want to learn that kind of those skills and that experience. And there are other kinds of trade programs that I think is so brilliant, Mad Academy, VADA, other academies in the district that offer young people alternatives to a strictly, high school degree, four-year college, that kind of a track. There's so many, like the VADA program is bordering the Green Lab. And they've just rebuilt that structure. And so you've got a fine art program bordering the garden program. We should go down there and check it out.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah.
I think being here this week, I've met a lot of young people, mostly women, who are very interested in gardens. And it's just so wonderful to see the new generations coming.
Uh-huh.
And, that they learn who I am and they're like, ah. And, but I just think it's, the diversity is so important. And I know the high school has started a lot of the trade things like carpentry and, working in cars and stuff. And we have to appeal to everyone. Not everyone wants to be an
accountant or a, yeah, exactly.
It doesn't work. So those alternatives are so important because we all need to be supported in what we love.
And who we are, right. And well, you and I talk a lot about that, about what education actually means and what, what do the young people need? And I want to just say that I remember, many of our long walks talking about these topics, and that's what birthed the Sustainability Symposium. Originally, your passion was all these young kids, they see this overwhelming world and it feels very scary, but we want to show them there's a lot going on that brings possibility. So talk a little bit about that, even though the program didn't end up really being about young people and bringing students in. That was the motivation for you to bring that in Lotus
Lane. It was the motivation.
Yeah, grabbed it up.
Yeah, I was working in Baja, actually, at this big berry farm, and I'd worked there for years, but I was invited to go to their laboratories, which I hadn't seen. So I went to these laboratories where they're doing all this research on organics and experimentations. And it was like a science fiction movie, people with robes and, their hair covered and these incredible rooms where, looking through a window and watching the scientists doing their things. And I thought, wow, this is, because my feeling was we hear so much doom and gloom these days, and not to say it's not a serious time, but there's a lot of positive things that happen. And my feeling was, to hit kids at that age, high school or teens or what, that age group is such a vulnerable age. And I don't have children myself, but I just think, if you're a young child these days growing up in these times, it's got to be tough. I mean, what's the future looking like? It's kind of grim.
Mm-hmm.
And not to say it's not, because it is, but there's a lot of really wonderful things that are happening and we don't hear about it. So that was the inspiration for the Sustainability Symposium is trying to reach younger people and say, the world is in a really bad state, but look at the possibilities.
We're hopeful.
It's hopeful. Yeah, it gives you hope. And to me, that's what art is all about, is hope.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, it didn't exactly work out to reach these kids, but we're not done yet.
No, we're not. We are far from done.
But it was a great learning experience. We've had two symposiums so far, mm-hmm. and it was a great learning experience for everyone involved. And I wanted to get Lotus Land involved as well. And this is something that I still struggle with, that Lotus Land and these things are really geared towards people who have the funds to be able to pay for these things. And my objective was to say, yeah, Lotus Land is this beautiful gardens. Unfortunately, they have to charge money to get into it. And this all may change, but that's another discussion. I didn't want to do the symposium at Lotus Land because I wanted to reach, you know, we had it in Santa Paula, which is a less affluent community, and it's all connected to Central California, you know, the farming industry.
That's right.
I'd love to include all those people and somehow bring them together with this entity that is more geared towards people who have, you know, more affluent.
And I would just also mention that Lotus Land, in their mission statement, educates, I believe it's fourth graders in Santa Barbara County. So they bring in busloads of kids and everybody gets to, I mean, as much as possible. That's one of their commitments.
Yeah. And it is a good goal. In fact, we had lunch the other day with Xavier, and we were talking. Xavier has so many ideas. He's the one who gave us the facility.
What is that? A old lemon packing house that it was at?
It's a lemon packing house from the early 1800s.
Wow.
Originally,
yeah, it was very cool.
85,000 square feet.
Oh.
He leases most of it out for car storage. There's like 350 cars being stored underneath it, but above in the original packing house, he has a party room. He has a lecture room. He has a little theater. So it was an opportunity that I said, would you ever want to do anything with Lotus Land? And he said, yes, I would love to, but I don't want to do another black tie event. So that, and then after being in Baja and seeing these laboratories and then talking to Xavier and seeing his thoughts on it, I kind of put the two together. So we're still, Xavier the other day at lunch had some ideas of how we can make Lotus Land completely free, where everyone can go in there.
Wow. I'll stay tuned for that one.
Yeah, it was way over my head. I mean, I can't tell you what he said because I didn't really understand it, but he has so many ideas. So I'm hoping these symposiums can continue and be more of an outreach to younger people, because again, like I said, there's such a vulnerable age group, and you know, just one little thing,
right? And you never know what it's going to be.
You never know. Yeah.
Now that, okay, reminds me that when we were doing this project at Santa Barbara High, you asked me, are there clubs? Is there any kind of an organized place for LGBT kids on campus? And I did not know. And I had to go check my sources. And yes, there was a little club. And I remember you and I meeting with them and wanting to really hear from them and support them. And how can we really help you? And what state is it in? And I'll never forget asking these young folks who had a lot of confidence and a lot of clarity about who they are and how they want to be on campus. But yes, there were gaps in what they would like. But when I said, do you have teachers on campus that you know are LGBTQ? And the fact is no one on campus was out on that campus. So that even still to this day, and this was, you know, a few years ago, but still, it's still maybe not okay in some schools to be who you are fully. And so the kids coming along that maybe identify as queer or, you know, however they identify, that how is that for them? And I remember that you started to really go on another journey that has led to a new project in your new home, Taos, New Mexico. And I'm wondering if you would say a little bit about that, because I think it's so interesting, sort of out of nothing. What was it, the magazine rack at Walmart was the only gathering place for, where are the gay gathering places? It's like, oh.
I still tell that story. But that's another thing close to my heart. And when I left California, I've been doing gardens my whole life, and I just decided it's time to find other things that I'm interested in. And when I was that age in high school, I was kicked out of the house because I was outed, which was a very painful thing. We don't need to go there. But there was, which is still here in Santa Barbara today, Pacific Pride Center. And thank God they had counselors and people to help people like me. And it was a time when there wasn't even a word gay. It was homosexual that you would look up in the encyclopedia and see that it was a mental disorder.
That's right. As a psychologist, that was in the DSM.
Yeah. So
how confusing.
Yeah. The
wow.
Shame.
Yeah.
To have this place where I could go to and be supported was life changing.
Wow.
So that's another.
Yeah, a huge, I did not know Pacific Pride, who I love. They do amazing programs. I did not know they'd been around for decades.
Yes, yes. And they've come a long way. So moving to New Mexico, that was another one of my endeavors was to.
You know, it's okay. We have feelings and these are deep subjects.
Notice I didn't apologize.
No, thank you.
So I've been doing for the last 3 years, I've been doing a lot of research. I'm in Taos about what is there. There's not a whole lot there for queer kids. But going through all this research, I have found that there are a lot of incredible supportive organizations for kids, like homeless teenagers. I mean, we have homeless teenagers as a home for them. I mean, what is wrong with this world? So I started investigating, and there's a lot of places that aren't necessarily geared towards LGBTQ kids, but they would include them, which is great. But I wanted to start something that zeroed right into queer kids. Mm-hmm. So my original intention was to start a support center. Well, I'm not equipped to do that. Because I don't have the time or...
Yeah, everybody has their specialty, the things they're good at. Yeah.
Right. So anyway, so now it's evolved into a foundation, which I'm working on starting. That what I want to do is have a website, and I want to label it as queer support, you know, adolescent queer support, whatever. And the man that's helping me create this nonprofit said, well, I don't know about the word queer. I mean, I think it should be gender neutral. I said, no, I want to go for the jugular. I want to hit home. Because if you're a kid and you're confused and not being supported, if you see something that isn't like zeroed right into who you are, it has to like hit you right where it's needed. That's how I feel. So, no, I said it needs to say queer.
Well, it's interesting because you and I have been talking in recent years, because as a psychologist, I also love sociology. I've been very interested in identity and all the social ways that we identify ourselves and the binary, only male, female. Now there's non-binary, which is also called queer. And that's more of a gender identity as opposed to an orientation, whether you're, you know, there are so many now, it hit even beyond when I've been studying. And it seems to me, you being who you are, you didn't grow up with that knowledge, but in the last 5 years, you have really educated yourself. And so,
I've learned a lot.
You know, there's gender orientation, so many things that we could speak to. And it's hard to find one word that captures all of it. You feel that queer may just kind of create a big enough field that everybody fits in there somewhere.
Well, I hope that's the case.
Right.
But, and I remember years ago, queer was like a really nasty word. You don't say
it
that.
It was derogatory. But it's been reclaimed. Wouldn't you say there's been a reclaim? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Reappropriation.
Well, so back to what I was saying, what I want to do is create this website where a queer kid or a queer anybody could go in and say, I want to list all these different organizations that's near where my hometown is. And I, you know, a brief description. So whatever your issue is, if you're a homeless queer kid, if you just want to, you know, support, whatever kind of support is needed, you can look on this website and see this is what's available. And then you can go in and say, this is what I need.
Right.
And through this journey that I've been on, I've like one time I interviewed these college kids and I told them what I was doing and really smart. I mean, kids are so smart.
They are so smart. Yeah.
and this one guy said, you know, it's the whole LGBTQ community is so much more accepted now. I think in a few years, you're not even going to need this support center. And I said, I strongly disagree with that because, you know, there's so much abuse. There's so much machismo and alcohol and drugs and so much hate out there. And mm-hmm. if you read the news at all, I mean, there's so much hate out there. I mean, it feels like we were really going forward and now we're going backwards again.
Right.
I don't think this is going to be easily rectified, this whole acceptance thing. So,
well, I think it's a goal. And I think that's my hope is that we get into all these distinctions and so many more kids. I mean, kids, I guess that's one of my things that I try to work on, not saying kids, young people identify as one or another of these things on a whole spectrum, you know, from trans to just simply being non-binary. And I have to admit that, you know, when I really analyze the notion of non-binary and I think about how do I experience myself, do I experience myself as female? No, I'm not like 100% that. So again, that would be non-binary. Do I see all issues either right or left, on or off, black or white? No. I mean, so the notion of binary, wouldn't it be neat if we could just let that just sort of be the norm at some point where we're all on a spectrum and we need the whole rainbow? I mean, not to be cliche, but that actually does sort of provide a good metaphor.
Well, that's interesting that you brought that up because that's another thing that I experience. You know, when I left California,
okay.
Well,
yeah. It's okay.
When I was outed, one of my brothers came up to me and looked me right in the eye and said, "Look what you've done to your mother." Oh. Well, that was just like.
And how old were you?
I was a teenager, you know, I don't know, 16, 17.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, you know, we never talked about it. You know, this is like 45 years later, we never talked about it. And I thought, you know, it's time to talk about it. So I reached out to him and I said, you know, I've forgiven you. It was a time, you know, it was a lot of ignorance. And I just want you to know that I've forgiven you. I'll never forget it, but I've forgiven you. And he wrote back and said, "Oh my God, I've been carrying this around for 45 years. Thank you so much." So we started this whole dialogue.
Wow.
Did the same thing with my younger sister, who was the one who actually did out me. And I can imagine the guilt and the
Shame.
The shame. Well, that's a key word, is shame.
Yeah.
I wrote her letter and kind of said the same thing. And I said, "I've been working a lot on the shame that I feel being a gay man." She said, "Well, what do you mean by shame?" And so I wrote her back and I said, "Well, first of all, it's really sad to me that you have to ask, but okay, because you're not in my shoes." So sure. So I started talking about shame and the shame that I've felt my whole life, you know, the shame from my family, the shame from society, the shame, you know, that the hate that I've experienced in my life. And of course, how could I not feel shameful? Mm-hmm. So that, and working through that made me realize, well, that's what pride marches are all about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. Pride, even using the word pride as the antidote to shame.
Yeah, and you know, being... being, you know, having something that it's who I am, it's how I feel. I'm attracted to men. Mm-hmm. You know, so what? Mm-hmm. But to be shamed for that, I mean, it'd be like, shame on you for being a heterosexual woman and loving a man. How could you do that?
Right. I mean, that's the experience. Absolutely.
That's the experience.
You didn't ask for that. You didn't wish it upon.
No, it's just, it's who I am. It's how I feel. Well, mm-hmm. Do I wish I was different? No, I don't. Because mm-hmm. I'm happy. You know, I love men. So what? Mm-hmm. I'm attracted to men. But working through this, I wrote her a 3-page letter and talked all about shame. Shame for this, shame for this, shame for this. And I'll tell you, writing that letter was the most healing thing I think I've ever done.
Wow. That's huge.
Unfortunately, she's suffering from dementia, so she didn't respond too much. But I copied a couple of other brothers on it, who had no idea because he was living up north. He had no idea about all this. He had no idea about what happened. And being able to express it and identify it and talk about it, I think it's been a real reawakening, not for me, but for them also.
Right.
You know, getting over the ignorance of being people being different and that can relate in so many things. I mean, you being a woman, I mean, you've been through it, you know.
Right. Anyone who's been marginalized and isn't.
We live in a white heterosexual man's world, mm-hmm. and we're still dealing with that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So being able to be fully who you are, and also what I'm hearing is that actually sustainable, regenerative, what do we know? We know that diversity, bringing every type of thing in, is what we need. That is how we're strong as a community, as a people, in our own hearts, is that opening. And what I was feeling like is that somehow, as a child, like you somehow were a seed that found a way to actually protect itself and grow and bloom. And as you've grown older and older, you've blossomed. And now you're able to kind of to go back to your origins and revisit some of those places that may not have been able to fully flower as a child. And you've been able to touch base with some of that. And to me, another word that comes up is holistic. It's like, can you love all parts of yourself? And if you do, I mean, what you're talking about, I know that landscape design may be your thing, but I hear world peace as your mission, a version of, and all we can do is the world we live in. And I see you really cultivating world peace in the garden that you live in.
Well, yeah, lots of thoughts on that. I did have this thing about gardens and plants that, yes, it helped me blossom. So that's this part of my life. But then this part of my life is like, I mean, obviously, you can tell by my expression, it's not easy getting over that stuff.
That's right.
It's been ingrained so much. I mean, the hate out there, and there's still so much hate out there.
Well, we can forgive, but sometimes not forget, right?
No, it's in my DNA. I mean, I'm shaking just talking about that.
Wow, that's a big deal, and that makes you courageous. That it still has that effect, and you're able to still now you're able to talk about it and share about it, which is a big deal.
Well, and. For me, you know, we talked earlier on in this conversation about self-esteem. Mm-hmm. I never really had any self-esteem until I really started working on this. And that was just very recent.
Mm. How would you say you worked on it? Like, how did you approach it for those of us that feel like we still have some work to do?
Well, talking to my siblings, talking about, you know, dirty secrets that happened in my life, talking about it and owning it and and not being repressed by it, being honest with myself and with other people, and mm-hmm. and saying, yes, I'm a gay man and I'm proud of it. Mm-hmm. But by acknowledging it and saying, yeah, this happened to me. You know, I talked about being molested by someone, and I felt really, first I felt really bad about saying that, and I thought, no, this is my story. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need to protect that person. This is my story. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm sorry that, you know, I didn't directly point the finger at this person, but it's my story. This is my pain.
Yeah. And what's interesting is here you are, a man with a Me Too story. I mean, we kind of affiliate that a lot with women, but it's not just women. It isn't.
No, it's not just.
We all have a story.
Everyone has a story. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. And so acknowledging these things and being able to speak through them and work through them, that's when I started feeling like, you know, like this is me, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm proud of it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so now I'm seeing you really reach out into your community and wanting to offer that space and that safety and that compassion and that love.
And that now we have this information that isn't under the carpet. You know, we can talk about these things. So, mm-hmm. you know, for young people today, yeah, it's a different world we live in. And I, it's not about poor me. It's about, this is what happened to me. And this is, you know, mm-hmm. I want to empower young people because I wasn't empowered.
And, you know, the other thing is tolerance and acceptance that there are all kinds of people with all kinds of different attitudes and not everyone sees things the same way. And just saying, okay, well, you know, my hope is that they come to a place where they can accept others for who they are, but you know, some people aren't there right now. So how do we find zones where we can be safe and we can be fully expressed is another thing. And providing a space where that's possible.
And recognizing that there is hate out there.
That's it.
Recognize that. You don't have to own it or, you know, participate in it, but yeah, it's out there and it hurts.
Mm. Well, you know, I'm thinking a lot has happened since you decided to leave Santa Barbara. You had such a brilliant, magical property that really sounds a lot like what you describe, I think, Jack Baker living. Like you lived over a little carriage house or something that was on the original stagecoach route. And your begonias. But also the sense of humor. You had all kinds of funny, fun things scattered throughout, you know, dolls and dolphins. But it was all done with such a sense of humor and beauty and fun. And then these begonias, like, what the heck?
I think I had like, I don't know, something like 250 varieties of begonias. I don't really know. But yeah, I had three. That garden was so special to me because it was something that sort of encapsulated everything I ever loved in my life, as far as the plant world. I could grow anything in that garden. I had three greenhouses. I had a cactus greenhouse. I had, you know, I could plant everything I always loved and play with them. And mm-hmm. But it reached a point where I did it. And you know, for me being a creative person, I always need that outlet for creativity. And I love a challenge. I love being courageous and trying new things, and that I kind of realized that complacency to me is a bad word. I was becoming a little complacent. Like, yeah, I could have stayed there the rest of my life and tinkered around in that garden and been perfectly happy, but would I be really happy? No. I need new adventures. I need to create new things and try new things. And at first when I left California, it was like, okay, I'm done with the garden.
I remember you said, I'm not having another garden. It's like,
Well, that lasted about a week. And then, you know, being in Taos, being in the town, I started seeing all these incredible things, like how things do well there and things that we can't grow here, like forsythia and peonies and being in a dry climate, seeing the perennials that I grow here and how over there. I remember as a kid going through plant catalogs and looking at pictures of plants, and I would think, those aren't real. Well, that's how they grow over there. So then I started, you know, turning around again, and I had this huge plant list of everything I was growing in my garden. And I thought, this doesn't make any sense, because it would be such a struggle. Because where I am outside of Taos, it's dry and it's hard soil. And as much as I loved my garden here, I didn't want to do that again. So now I've refocused it into a smaller palette of plants, mostly natives and wildflowers, which still gives me that creative outlet, and I can still learn about things because it is a new palette, but I don't have to work so hard at it, you know. I've kind of done that, and as much as I loved it, I want to do other things. I want to work with kids and you know, help other people. I want to travel, you know. It's been really interesting. And I've done a lot of work on myself. You know, I spend a lot of time walking. Yeah. I walk 2 or 3 hours every day, and I don't know, maybe I think too much, I don't know. But I've worked through a lot of different things in my life, and I'm really happy.
Wow. You can't really do better than that. And sharing love. You're doing it. Well, I have to say, I love you. I love your story. Thank you so much for sharing who you are. And
oh, we could go on for hours, right?
Oh, and yes, we could. And I've told you for a long time, I want to sit you down. We need to tape this conversation. We always say that, but we finally did.
We should start a TV show.
Okay, you're on. Well, anyway, thank you for being here. And as always, I love you. And thank you for making the world a more beautiful, more loving place.
And I'm hoping this podcast will reach, you know, touch some people. Let's touch people. Let's make a difference.
Yeah.
I think you and I talked a while ago, and we were saying how we want our lives to mean something, you know. I could, you know, be perfectly happy, you know, going, you know, I'd love to be smoking cigarettes, but no, I want it to mean something. You know, I don't want to just live life and, you know, and enjoy it. I want to work hard and, you know, get my hands dirty and, you know, that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. So if we can instill that ambition in other people, cool.
Well, I believe that you have, and you do, and you will. So
let's work together, right?
Please, yeah. I'm in. Mwah. Ta-ta. That's a wrap for today's episode of Regenerative Spaces. If you found this episode valuable or thought-provoking, share it with a friend and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'll keep the conversation going over on Instagram, so join me at Stacy Pellice and share your thoughts, questions, or suggestions for future episodes. I love hearing from you. And before we go, your support means the world to me. If you have a moment, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help us reach even more people looking to spark sustainable change in our world. Stay curious, stay inspired, and until next time, this is Stacy Pellice, and you've been listening to Regenerative Spaces.